Welcome to a new episode of the Film at Lincoln Center podcast. This week, we're excited to present two conversations. First up, with our retrospective celebrating the films of the late Polish director Wojciech Jerzy-Haas, currently running through March 31st, listen to myself, digital marketing manager Eric Lures, discuss the career of the filmmaker with Annette Insdorf, a celebrated scholar and author of the book Intimations, the Films of Wojciech Haas. Get tickets to the retrospective at filmlink.org/HAS. Following that conversation, we're happy to share a Q&A from the 61st New York Film Festival with La Camera director Alicia Rohrwacher and actors Josh O'Connor and Isabella Rossellini, moderated by NYFF advisor Michelle Carey. With her customarily bewitching mixture of earthiness and magical realism, Alicia Rohrwacher conjures a marvelous entertainment set in a rural Italy, eternally caught between the ancient and the modern. La Camera opens at FLC next Friday, March 29th. View showtimes and get tickets now at filmlink.org/CHIMERA. Now please enjoy the conversation between myself and Annette Insdorf on Wojciech Jerzy-Haas, followed by a Q&A with the team behind La Camera.
I first heard the name Wojciech Haas when I was in my early 20s. I went to a midnight screening of the Saragossa manuscript at Manhattan's Elgin Cinema. It no longer exists, but it was very important in the basically late 70s, early 80s. And I had never taken LSD. I still haven't. But when the movie ended at 3 a.m., I did feel like I experienced some kind of drug-induced high because I could not believe that I was seeing a delirious narration of a story within a story within a story. And it had this hallucinatory feeling. It was the displacement of a Polish movie about a Belgian officer set in Spain. And it had this ironic treatment of men bewitched by semi-naked women. A few years later, my mother was teaching at Hunter College, French literature and French film. And because of her, I attended a special screening. And it was the Hourglass Sanatorium, because I recognized Wojciech Haas's name. And again, this movie just fascinated me. I had never seen such an evocation of Hasidic life in Poland between the world wars. It was Jewish experience on screen, but surreal. And then in 1997, the Film Society of Lincoln Center presented a retrospective of Haas's films. It was the sidebar of the New York Film Festival that year, programmed by the great Richard Pena. He showed 10 features. And the title of the series was Logic of Dream, Logic of Labyrinth, The Fantastic Journeys of Wojciech Jerzy-Haas. Well, I started to watch more of his films, and the one that was a true revelation for me was The Noose. It was so hard to believe that this stark poetic drama was a first feature for Haas, as well as his lead actor, Gustav Holubek, and his cinematographer, Mieczysław Jahoda. It's about an alcoholic man. He's very lucid, post-war. He knows he will not succeed in kicking the habit. And I was writing my book at that time about Kieślowski's work. And I realized that Kieślowski's Blind Chance was deeply connected to The Noose. I saw how both films were poetically conveying a kind of existential despair through formal choices that included this circular narration. And I sensed that Haas's drama had influenced Kieślowski. Another thing you should know is that every year, the great Polish film critic and Lodz Film School professor, Maria Kornatowska, she would come to the New York Film Festival. And we talked all the time about Polish cinema, and she really encouraged my interest in Haas's work. She thought that he was a true master. And when I read her incisive monograph, it's called something like, Yet We Do Not Know What Will Become of Us, on the artistic output of Wojciech Jerzy-Haas, I read it and I had to agree. It was only 10 pages, but she managed to articulate what was unique and provocative about his cinema and to contextualize it in a rather pungent remark. She called Poland's theater of the absurd the most genuine truth about the so-called great constructions of socialism. And then I finally decided to write my book after discussions with Hanna Hartowicz. She's a New York-based graduate of the Lodz Film School. She knew Haas very well. And she offered to help with my research. She was invaluable as a knowledgeable translator. She was a witness, an accomplice. She accompanied me to Warsaw in June of 2014. And I also went to Krakow at that time because Haas was born there, and Krakow happens to be the city of my mother's birth. I visited the buildings where Haas's presence is marked. And in Warsaw and Lodz, I interviewed Haas's former students from the Lodz Film School, as well as his collaborators.
Yeah, and I was wondering then, in interviewing those former students and collaborators as well, I feel like that's an interesting way to also somewhat of an, maybe not excavation, but I was curious about those kind of extra details then that you learned from speaking with them in your research, and how valuable that was in the forming of your book.
It was extremely valuable for a main reason. All the monographs I had written prior to this one were about filmmakers who I knew personally. I heard their voices in my head. In fact, I had been the translator for my first book, François Truffaut. I had been Truffaut's translator for my book on Kieślowski. I had been his translator. For my book on Philip Kaufman, I knew him well. We had become good friends. But Haas died before this ever became a possibility. So I needed to talk to people who did know him, because it wasn't enough to watch his films, to read about his work. I needed to get the personal details. So I learned from Małgorzata Szumowska, for example, who's now a leading Polish director, and the dean of the film school. I mean, there's so many. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on names right now. But what they basically led me to understand is that Haas was this intransigent individualist. He was a chain smoker, by the way. He was a nonconformist who spoke quite little, but whose words meant a lot to his pupils and colleagues. They told me that he never joined the Communist Party, for example, and that he often eluded censorship by adapting novels that were set in the past. He refused to direct any contemporary films. And his former students in 2014, they recalled to me his singular attention to detail, beginning with an elaborate scenopis. That's the Polish word for a very detailed hand-drawn storyboard. Then I returned to Poland in the summer of 2015. I met with other students of his, and these impressions were confirmed. His cinematographer, Grzegorz Kędzierski, said that Haas did not want to be categorized in any way, that he was free from all labels, whether religious or national. He defined himself as an artist. And I also came to realize how different Haas's cinema was from, say, Andrzej Wajda, his great contemporary, or some of the leading Polish directors who came a bit after him, like Kieślowski, Roman Polanski, Agnieszka Holland. He had a unique tone and penchant for thematic aspects.
And I guess also then, how have you seen his impact on other filmmakers? If you have, sometimes I know that can be a little bit harder to suss out than others in terms of filmmakers' traits and their long-lasting influence on contemporaries and perhaps a generations that have come thereafter. And I guess maybe a better way to form that question is to ask, have you seen his impact on other filmmakers?
I guess in the case of Haas, what I have to admit is that it is clear, because I interviewed filmmakers who talked about him. In other words, I can't really say to you, oh, look at how Coppola's film reflects, but Haas's movie struck a deep chord with admirers like Scorsese, who programmed two of his features in a traveling exhibition of Polish cinema back in 2014. Buñuel, his autobiography lauds the Saragossa manuscript, which he saw three times, and even helped to arrange a distribution deal for the film in Mexico. Now, Roman Polanski is one of the Polish-born directors with international careers who acknowledged Haas's talent when he was interviewed in the early 1960s. I found that. And I got to speak to Polanski in July of 2015 in Krakow. And I asked him about inspiration, whatever. And he singled out two films, The Noose and The Saragossa Manuscript, as his favorites. Then, cut to a few years later, it was maybe more or less around the same time. I interviewed in my 92nd Street Y series, Real Pieces, Pavel Pawlikowski, who directed the Oscar-winning Ida. And that was January 2015, actually. I asked him about the possible inspiration of films like How to Be Loved or The Noose, to which he replied, Haas is a completely unrecognized genius, probably the most talented Polish director since the war, with his own sensibility and vision. So it's not so much that I'm able to tell you where in which film you could see it, being something of a historian who does a lot of research, whether for my classes at Columbia University or writing a book, I prefer to interview whoever possible about what they love. Coppola. I got to interview Coppola at the 92nd Street. I think it was around 2018. And I asked him about Haas. And he said that the Saragossa manuscript fascinated him, that he loves it. And he added that it was unique in construction. He also emailed me about Haas's work, because I emailed him telling him I was writing the book, about his profound admiration. I mean, Coppola is extremely well-versed in international cinema altogether, but especially Polish film, and that is true of Scorsese as well. You might not know that, because unless the moderator interviewer is someone like me who specifically asks about a Vida film or a Haas film, you won't necessarily hear that Polish cinema is so significant to them.
And then also curious about, maybe you've mentioned a few of the titles, of course, of that he's directed, but are there any films in his filmography that you think might have been even more underseen, or some of the more undiscovered gems in this series that you'd like to recommend?
Most assuredly. I'm telling my students to see as many as they can. If I had to narrow down to two that are not the famous ones, I would seek out both The Noose and An Uneventful Story from 1983, because both films, they star the same actor, Gustav Holubek, as a hyper-lucid man who senses both the meaninglessness of life and his proximity to death. For An Uneventful Story, Haas wrote his own screenplay adaptation of Chekhov's short story. He thickened that late 19th century tale's sadness with post-World War II despair. And even if the films were made 25 years apart, they are for me unified by this formally vibrant treatment of what we could call existential lassitude. At the center of these cinematic variations on a theme, Holubek incarnates an alcoholic in The Noose and a professor of medicine in An Uneventful Story. The sheer acuteness of his ironic glance at himself and the world makes him a compelling subject in both films. They remind me of how Haas was a prose poet of solitude and alienation. He was much more of a formalist than a realist.
Absolutely. And we are calling this retrospective The Long Strange Trips of Wojciech Jerzy Haas. That might sound a little odd to anyone if they're not familiar with perhaps some fans of his. It is a direct reference to a specific artist who was a very big fan of the director. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to Jerry Garcia's fandom and fascination with the filmmaker.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so this lead guitarist of the popular counterculture band The Grateful Dead called the Saragossa manuscript his favorite movie. He helped the Pacific Film Archive in California obtain a complete print of the film in the 1990s. Scorsese and Coppola later financed the digital restoration of the uncut version. So, you know, this Jerry Garcia connection is endlessly fascinating to me. I figure there was something about the world of Haas that really struck a chord in Jerry Garcia.
I did not know that prior actually to the formation of this series. So that was something fascinating for me to learn and go back and read up on. And of course, in addition to the series, Annette, you will also be on hand to introduce a few of the screenings. And we will have copies of Annette's book, Intimations, The Cinema of Wojciech Haas, on sale for $20. And Annette will be signing copies at those screenings as well. The series will be running from March 22nd through March 31st. And once again, that will include each of Haas's 14 features and all of his short films as well. So it is a great deep dive if you've never seen a film by the director, or if you want to catch up on those you have missed, it's a great opportunity to do so. You can see the entire schedule and get tickets at filmlink.org/HAS. That's filmlink.org/Haas. I hope everyone comes out between March 22nd through the 31st. And Annette, we look forward to having you there for some of the screenings. And thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Taking place from April 3rd through April 14th, Film at Lincoln Center and the Museum of Modern Art present the 53rd edition of New Directors, New Films, the annual festival that presents filmmakers who speak to the present and anticipate the future of cinema, and whose bold work pushes the envelope in unexpected, striking ways. This year's selection will introduce 25 features and 10 shorts, including one world premiere, 14 North American, 5 U.S., and 15 New York premieres. Tickets are now on sale at newdirectors.org.
Please welcome back Alicia Rohrwacher, Isabella Rossellini, and Josh O'Connor, and our interpreter. Thank you again. And Alicia, I wanted to start with these tombolari, these people you mentioned you were growing up with their stories. And I wanted to know, I guess, what fascinated you about them and what they represented, also with respect to this region you grew up in Italy, and also whether you ever came across them face to face as a child.
Sì, buongiorno, buonasera.
We look at these grave robbers that come off as fun and lighthearted, and what we don't realize is that behind that there's a trafficking of archaeological goods that took place in the 80s and the 90s that, according to a famous journalist such as Fabio Wiesman, they created a market that was even broader and bigger in terms of revenue than the drug market. So the face behind that was also the one of these older men in the little town that I was from, and the whole general area, the whole region, that would just go and dig and rob, and then would brag about their adventures and without thinking about what they had destroyed. And they would go to these bars and these country sort of little osterias, and they would just talk and have this braggadocio about everything that they had stolen. And they felt they had the right to just go and dig and excavate. And what I was thinking was, well, these people can escape the law of the living, the law of the day, of the police. But what about the law of the night, the law of the dead? These things were things, items that belonged to souls. And so how can they think that they could just seize what belonged to a whole other soul and human being? Also, the other thing I wanted to reflect upon is that for 2,500 years, all those items were down there and nobody touched them. And now there's a new generation that says, no, I have a right to get it. And so how could they not think about it? It led me to believe that there's a whole new generation that in terms of spirituality does not have that kind of concern.
Thank you. And it's such a multi-layered film. I mean, as I wanted to ask you actually about the comedy in the film, because it's a very funny film. I mean, particularly through the character of Italia in the beginning, who I think, you know, Carol Duarte is not here with us, but she's amazing. She's so fantastic in the film. Yeah, can we give her a... She's not here. I mean, all the cast are fantastic. But I wanted to ask about cinematic references. It's almost, there's some moments that almost have like a Keystone Cops sort of comedy to it, with the sped up, you know, these scenes with the sped up, and there's a real sense of comedy. I was interested if there was any Italian comedy influences on the film this time.
Yes, first of all, it's a movie about the, come si dice, l'aldilà, the beyond, the dead. Has to be funny. Because it's not so funny argument, and it's about a pain. It's about un uomo molto addolorato. C'era questo personaggio molto triste, molto addolorato. Quindi volevo che fosse leggero.
This character was full of pain. It was very sad, and so I wanted a light-hearted side. I believe that definitely there is a sense of belonging to a great tradition of Italian filmmaker. We're sitting here next to Isabella Rossellini, and definitely there are influences from her father. There's a long tradition of movies that were serious, but always done with irony. I come from a country, Italy, that has always been able to laugh about its own tragedies. So I can't point out a specific single direct influence. However, in everything, in all of our gestures, in all of our imagination, there is a legacy of our time, where what has shaped us, when that goes from a glass that we touch to a word we use. And so in this collective community legacy, there is definitely the tradition of filmmaking that has nourished me and has definitely nourished my imagination as well.
And I think it's felicitous that your first feature film, Corpo Celeste, was sort of concerned with the heavenly world, what's up there, and now with your latest, we've gone underground. And Josh, I want to ask you about this very striking final scene, which is... it's mysterious. We don't quite know where it's going. Is it opening up another adventure? But it's ultimately, you know, very romantic, I think. But I was also wondering what it was like, the mechanics of shooting. Were you underground, or how did you shoot that also with your DOP, Hélène Louvard, and Alicia? Who was there with you, and was that underground, or how was that done?
There weren't many of us. We were underground. It was a very small space. Where we shot that, where we were shooting in Lice's part of the world, there are lots of tombs that are still there. Some have been excavated and some haven't. And so we were there was one cave like this. That was one entrance. And then I would go round to another cave where they had built a tunnel. Mm-hmm. Well, the tunnel was already there. And we'd built a beginning of the tunnel so I could jump down. And then they collapsed the tunnel behind me.
Funny. Very funny.
Very funny. For them, it was hilarious.
I can say that we put the camera on an arm, so we were not there, just Josh and the camera. We were in a safe place, taking a cappuccino.
And then I crawled through, and I was, it's very. I think it's very romantic.
Well, we're going to start the. We'll open the questions up with you guys in a moment, but Isabella, I want to ask you, of course, for your beautiful role, which is doesn't have the most screen time, but I think is so important. This beautiful relationship you have with Arthur. And this great scene you have with all your daughters, you know, talking over each other. It's so funny. And I just wanted to ask what it was like for you, your experience on this film and how you came to Alicia's work.
So I've seen all Alicia's film. And I had the impression, because she works with a lot of non-professional actors and professional actors, and they all overlap and talk together, that I thought there was a certain amount of improvisation. And I was amazed to see that nothing is improvised, that everything is scripted, and we rehearse many times with my daughters came, and we rehearsed almost like a choir. So we spoke, and then that word had to come out so that you understand that accent of the scene or that word. And I was amazed. And the scene with my daughters, when I read them, I said, I was going to take so long to shoot them. And it took very few hours. They were incredibly well rehearsed, and this idea that Alicia has, that is very original, to create a protagonist, Josh, Arthur, but the surroundings, not other people, they are a choir of people that are moving around. So she illustrates also a culture, a vaster culture. And I just saw it happened, and I was amazed how you could choreograph and work like an orchestra director.
Okay, please raise your hand if you have questions. Oh, we have so many already. We have a mic down here and one there. So let's start just down the front, if we could bring the mic down the front row. Thank you.
As always in your films, there are lots of elements of fairy tales and legend and myth. And there's Ariadne in this case, and maybe the daughters are a bit like three fairies, good or evil. And there are seven little dwarf helpers of Arthur. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Fairy tales. Le fiabe sono vere, no? Come dice Italo Calvino.
Fairy tales are like a distillation of reality. They're like a grappa of reality. They always stem from a real happening, and then they go back to it. They give it back. So this is the way that I have of approaching reality in a non-pornographic way, so to speak. So I exploit something that happens in reality, but I give it back in a distilled manner. Definitely in all of my films, there is this element of magic, and I am sort of ashamed of it. And I want to take a step back and talk about embarrassment. For example, the image of the red thread, I was embarrassed about it because it's such a commonplace image. So when I think of it, a red thread, that's shameful. I can come up with something more complex than that. That is almost banal. That's so commonplace, so every day. But in this embarrassment, there is something that's true. There's truth in it. And so I think that out of this embarrassment, we can take out some things that are alive, some elements that are straightforward, that are revelatory, and we can start from that and then give them body, the way I did with the red thread. And sometimes being able to do something like that is something that surprises myself as well.
Hi, thank you so much for this incredibly beautiful movie. As I was watching it, I noticed that there were 3 to 4 like different aspect ratios at play. One, it seemed like one's for the dreams and other different worlds. And I was wondering, what was your decision behind that and how that made it into the final film?
Aspect ratio. this is a movie, I think it's simple, about also about archaeology. So also images have a story. So we can use the archaeology of images as well. We can use the story of images to show, to tell a story. So I wanted to keep in the movie i differenti formati che hanno permesso la storia del cinema.
That have made the history of cinema possible.
Non tutti, però diciamo i principali.
Not all of them, but just the main ones.
E quindi passare
so we go from an amateur-like 16 millimeter to a super 16 millimeter that's more narrative, more synthetic, to the 35 millimeter, which is more pictorial.
And we decide with Hélène Louvard, the greatest for me, my beloved director of photography that works with me, we decide to use these different formats, aspect ratio, with a feeling, not with a reason. Like there was scenes that we felt we need to see more, like 35, and there are scene, then we want to stay a little bit outside, you know? Like, so we was a feeling that was our guide.
Yes, there's some down here, yes. Yes, you can go first, yes, thank you. The mic's coming.
Hello, thank you for this wonderful film. This is a question for Mr. O'Connor. There's this kind of almost Antonioni-like alienation with your character, I think, and the Italian environment around you as the sort of British person. Can you talk about how you maybe internalized the that sort of cultural diffusion, I guess? I don't know if you want to call it that, sure.
I think just being in the orbit of Alice, it's very infectious. She's like, Alice lives the most beautiful and pure life, and she's a pure soul. And so it's very, we are all kind of caught up in her orbit very quickly. It's not true. No, I'm joking. It is. It really is. And so, so I suppose so. There's that. Also, there is the. I think the relationship between sort of non-professional actors, whatever, they're all fantastic. But like, you know, being in an environment where my entire gang of Tombarolia are of the area, many have known Alice for their whole lives, and there is this element of like, you know, that was they were the people I was spending my time with. And so you, and of course, you know, that is, there is an, I work and all actors work in the business of empathy, and the best way of showing empathy is to sort of, mirror others. And so I think all those things were just happening inevitably, but I think that the kind of fundamental thing was that Alice, this sort of environment that she was creating was infectious and something you wanted to kind of replicate and mirror. So I think it's probably that, really.
And you also had a question? Yeah.
Hi, thank you guys for this film. I loved it. So I have two questions. The first one is, I don't know if I was hallucinating, but I saw the main character in Happy as Lazaro in the movie. Is that correct? And second of all is it's a very colorful film. There's a lot of different kinds of costumes, and there was one specific scene where there was a lot of like cross dressing. I want you to talk about if there's like a custom in Italy that kind of your reference to how that plays in the role of the movie, and also the costume of Josh O'Connor's character and how that like elevates the film.
Yes, it's Lazzaro. It's passing by because he played the bastu, come si chiama? Trombone. Yes, And we want to, there are a lot of people from Lazzaro that they said, ah, can I come for one day? And say, okay. And so I think about colors, it's a lot in the movie, means a lot. There is the black, the white, like all the colors, no colors. And then there is the arcobaleno, the rainbow, that is Beniamina. And there are the sisters that are... So was a very important research on the symbolic point of the colors. But also we love reality, so there was...
We walked on a fine line with my costume designer so that we could have the symbolic value of colors. But on the other hand, we didn't want for the symbolic value to eat the movie. So my hope was that people can watch the movie and perceive the symbolism without being taken over by the power of symbolism.
It's always from the fairy tales that all this symbolism came from.
And if I may, I think the question was also about there's this scene in the middle. There's a man in makeup and fabulous dress, and they're wondering if that's an Italian costume or where did that come from?
So the film also talks about what it's like to be male in Italy in the 80s, because we were discussing that earlier. As women, for thousands of years, we've been in a second place position and we've been subjugated. And so we've wondered, we've analyzed what it means to be a woman. However, men have done so much less. So being a man in the 80s with all the weight of the patriarchy felt like a prison. At least that's the way I saw it. I had no envy whatsoever of men back then. They needed to come off as machos and to be rude and to use swear words. Poor things. That's what I would tell myself. So the first time we see them, it's for this carnival-like event, which was the day of the Epiphany. And the tradition was that men would dress up as women. And because of what we said, that their vision of what a woman would be like is almost like a prostitute, you know, with exaggerated makeup and big boobs. So I just wanted to show them immediately with the contradiction that they're like. But I also wanted to show Arthur, who feels whatever is lacking, that is his gift, while he's able to perceive that there's also another aspect, another component to this event, to this celebration. It's an event that binds together a community. And so he's able to see the tenderness that is something that is lacking for a lot of people, especially those who don't have it.
Thank you so much for an exquisite movie and just the best 2 hours I've had for years. It's very interesting that there are two love stories in the movie, for Arthur anyway. They're not front and center, you know, they're not in the foreground of the movie, but they're two love stories with very different women who represented very different things. And I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about why they were there and what they meant for you.
So I wanted to talk about what love is. With love, we recognize that there's something missing within us. And we find somebody or something that fills that void. And so everything starts from a void. And we perceive in somebody else that there is something to fill that. And when I met these water diviners and I met them, that I understood that they are able to feel where water is because they are missing that within that. There's a vacuum within that, and they're able to fill that. So the idea was that Arthur loved somebody that is no longer there, that it can no, that somebody who can no longer come back, who is in the mythological beyond, but he is connected by a thread to this person. At the same time, he's not completely crazy. He's not completely out of it. He doesn't live in a mythological reality the way Flora does. She is completely immersed in a mythological world. He is able to live in reality, and he does fall in love with somebody who's called Italia, the same name as the country that he loves so much. The same way, at the same time, he's not able to immerse himself in that love to the bottom of it because that thread is still there and it does pull him back all the time. For many years, I set myself the goal to memorize one poem every 2 weeks. And they would not be poems that I would choose for myself. I would ask other people to suggest a poem to me because I felt that I wanted poems that I never would have chosen on my own. And I find that memorizing a poem, even though it's something that at the moment we don't fully understand, well, it is something that creates a treasure within us. And one day, sooner or later, we will understand and something will come up that will show us what we were meant to understand. It may not happen right away. For somebody, it may not even happen at all. Somebody will get it right away. And for somebody else, this will be stuck and then like a thread, and then that thread will be pulled by something else because it will be stuck somewhere and then it will be unraveled.
Well, I think it's very fitting to end on poetry for this film. So thank you for your questions. There's so much more we could talk about.
Thank you very much.
Please thank all our guests and the great Maria.